This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
If you were here with us last week, you heard a fascinating conversation about the universe and the great cosmic voids of outer space and time. I figured this week we'd stay out there, only instead of voids, we'd have talking robots and laser bells.
I got to make a profit on being a fan of Star Wars.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk to Kevin J. Anderson, one of the most prolific and best-selling science fiction authors working today. Then we'll come back down to Earth and hear how students in Oregon are using language to learn just about everything else. And we'll spend an academic minute with writer's block. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. You've heard this about some other people, but Kevin J. Anderson really does seem to be the hardest working man in showbiz. Anderson has published over 120 science fiction books, including a couple of dozen best-selling Star Wars novels. I spoke to Kevin J. Anderson as he was getting ready to appear at Pensacon, the Florida Panhandle's answer to Comic-Con last month, and I asked him how he became a part of the Star Wars universe and so many other science fiction worlds.
Well, one happens to be very lucky, I guess. This was a long time ago, like in the early 1990s when I was working for the publisher Bantam Books, and I was just a science fiction writer. I was writing my own books for Bantam, and I didn't know I was auditioning. I was working easily with the editor, and I turned in my books on time, and I wrote books that everybody liked to read. And behind my back, goody for her, my editor submitted my name to Lucasfilm as, why don't you have this guy write Star Wars books? And they read my work and liked it, and so I just got a call out of the blue if I would like to write three sequels to Star Wars, and that was the Jedi Academy trilogy. That was just the start. I ended up writing a total of 54 projects for Lucasfilm. Haven't worked for them in a little while, but that was just comic books and pop-up books and a young adult series with my wife, Rebecca Mesta, and I did three anthologies and novels and all kinds of stuff that I did for Lucasfilm. So I got to make a profit on being a fan of Star Wars.
Well, that's a nice gig if you can get it.
Yeah. Well, and then after I'm winding up the Star Wars work, then Chris Carter from The X-Files read my Star Wars books and liked them, so they contacted me to see if I would write X-Files books. And not long after that, I teamed up with Brian Herbert, the son of Frank Herbert, who wrote the original novel Dune. And he and I started writing Dune novels because his father had died and left a bunch of notes for other novels in the works. And we are just wrapping up, I think, our 15th one right now, and they've all been international bestsellers, and that's a major universe. So I'm exploring all these different universes, and I'm writing my own stuff, too.
When you do a series with a franchise like Star Wars, how much leeway are you given to monkey with the characters? I mean, these are iconic characters. Do you have a Bible like, you know, you can't make Yoda evil or something like that?
Well, if you do, you have to get them better by the end of the episode, I guess.
Okay.
Well, a lot of what you're asking really, really depends on the licensor, in this case, Lucasfilm, and how adaptable they are. Some of them are very rigid and won't let you do anything. Some of them just don't care and say, I don't mind, just do whatever you want. Lucasfilm was, they certainly cared a great deal, but I was one of the first writers who started doing Star Wars books, so the territory was unexplored. And I had a great deal of freedom to make up my own stories and characters and make the established characters that Luke Skywalker and Han Solo and Princess Leia grow and change over the period of time. And the authors in my generation who were working on all those were like a team. We all knew what each other was doing, and we would be on the phone all the time so that everybody knew what was coming down the pipeline. And Lucasfilm was very easy to work with, and, you know, there were some things that they didn't want us to do, like, you know, I could not kill off Luke no matter how much I wanted to if that story was going on, but that wasn't what was going to happen. We had to color within the lines, but we had lots of freedom to go to plenty of different planets, and, you know, the Star Wars movies look pretty darn spectacular, but when I'm writing a book, I have a bigger special effects budget than even Industrial Light and Magic does, so I could come up with whatever I wanted, blow up planets and stars and create the creepiest alien races and all sorts of things that would be maybe even too expensive to put in a movie.
Talk a little bit about the Dune books, because you are writing them with the son of the original author. How is that collaboration done?
Well, Dune was always my favorite science fiction book of all time. I'm sure most people have seen the movie or the TV miniseries of it, but the book itself came out in the mid-1960s, and when I read it, I think I was in early high school when I read it, it just blew me away. This was the most epic science fiction novel I had ever read, sort of like The Lord of the Rings for science fiction. And I just loved it, and I read all of the sequels, but Frank Herbert passed away and left his last book that he wrote just on a cliffhanger, so there was obviously more to come in the story, but he wasn't around to write it. And my own writing career was taking off, and about 10 years after his father had died, I contacted Brian Herbert and just said, you know, this shouldn't be left unfinished. We need to at least tell the story so that as fans we know how it ended, if nothing else. So we got together and we found some notes that his father had left behind for what he had intended to do with the story. And then we just brainstormed and wrote the first trilogy, and that kind of took off. We were planning all sorts of stories along the way, and we're now just finished the draft of Navigators of Dune, which ends a trilogy for another piece of the history of Dune.
And you're working with him on another series, too, the Hellhole series?
Yeah, after doing like a dozen Dune books, we figured out that we knew how to work well together. We enjoyed each other's company, and we liked each other's imagination. And after doing a dozen of those big, complicated Dune books, we set off to do our own series as well. It's also big, epic science fiction, so the people who like Dune will like the Hellhole series. But we mapped out an original trilogy, and we just published the third book. Was about 6 months ago. It came out in hardcover, and it'll be out in paperback in a few months. So it is our own story about a planet that's been struck by an asteroid, well, a group of people trying to colonize a planet that's been struck by an asteroid. So there's earthquakes and volcanoes and storms, and it's not really Club Med. You know, it's a pretty hellish place to be settling. So the only people who go to a place like that are the people who don't have any place else to go. They're the outlaws and the misfits and the religious fanatics and people who are on the run from something. So it's an interesting batch of misfits who are trying to survive on this planet that's trying to kill them. And we did three books of those, and very pleased with how it turned out.
One other project I'd like to hear about is the collaboration you did with the rock group Rush, the book Clockwork Angels, and you have a new one on the way, right?
Yeah, that was just a fabulous thing for me. You know, since I was a freshman at high school, which was mid to late 1970s, the rock band Rush was one of my favorites because I was this nerdy kid with thick glasses and bad haircut. So all these songs about falling in love or losing your girlfriend didn't have a whole lot of relevance to me because I didn't have a girlfriend anyway. But Rush had these albums about spaceships going to black holes and fantasy stories about finding magical lands and dystopias in the future with the repressive system of government. And that just really fascinated me. And my very first novel was inspired by a Rush album, and I put that in the acknowledgments of the book. And shortly after that book was published, I got a letter from Neil Peart, who's the drummer for Rush, and also the guy who writes the lyrics to all their songs. And we struck up a friendship, and we've known each other for 25 years. And the most recent album that Rush released is called Clockwork Angels, which is a big concept album with a steampunk fantasy adventure with an anarchist and pirates and lost cities and airships and all kinds of interesting fantasy things going on. And when they were planning the album, Neil Peart contacted me to sort of brainstorm the story, and it was his idea that it should be a novel, and of course he wanted me to write it, and I was very thrilled about that. So we collaborated and brainstormed it, so Clockwork Angels, the novel, came out while Rush was on tour for the Clockwork Angels album, and they were selling the book at the concert, and it was sold, well, in bookstores too. It hit the New York Times bestseller list. And it was just a fantastic experience, and the fans loved it, and there was all kinds of things that are little Rush Easter eggs throughout. And because that was so successful, we did a graphic novel version of it that was published in six issues by Boom Studios, one of the largest comic publishers. But that wasn't enough. After 2 years of signing these books and going on tour and doing all kinds of stuff, we had lots of other stories that we wanted to tell, and that just kept coming back to us, and this summer started writing a new one called Clockwork Lives, which ties up all these other ideas that we had. and I've just finished it, and we're doing the final edits right now. In fact, that's what I was doing before you called. And that book will be out in September, and we're just really jazzed about it. It's also got the same fantastical stuff and alchemy miners and monsters in the sea and destructive wreckers who are like pirates and bandits that are hijacking airships and, you know, the fabulous adventure stuff that we don't really see in everyday life, but it's fun to read about.
Sounds great. What about the work that you do with aspiring writers?
Well, when I was a new writer starting out, I had a lot of other authors and teachers who helped me out, so it's like paying it forward. One of my first mentors who helped me get my main agent and got some book deals was Dean Koontz, who somewhat well-known suspense author, Dean Koontz. He was one of my mentors, and I had some other authors that took me under their wing, and so I've been doing that myself for about the past 10 years, teaching new writers. But instead of teaching them the craft of, you know, how to write a scene or how to develop a character, I focus more on the business aspects of a writing career, how to understand your contracts and copyrights and how to get publicity and how to build a fan base, the things that a lot of writers I see who are brilliant writers just don't know how to make that extra step so that they become professional career authors. And every year I run a fairly large conference here in Colorado Springs called the Superstars Writing Seminar. We just finished our most recent one a couple weeks ago. And that's been growing by leaps and bounds. We've done that for 6 years now. And I've been a judge for the Writers of the Future contest. That is quarterly. You can Google it. That's an amazing contest for new writers. My wife and I also teach one of the workshops there in Hollywood where they have it. And I give, well, I've, at Pensacon I'll just have a couple of panels, I think. But normally when I go to these shows, we do some writing workshop stuff and some craft panels as well, because it's a great place where fans and aspiring writers gather, and it's their chance to meet us, to ask us questions, to get books signed, and take their opportunity to learn what they can.
When you do a show like a Pensacon or any other convention, what do the fans usually want to know?
Well, they want to know if I'm going to write any other Star Wars books, but I'm happy to, but I haven't been asked for a little while. They want to know if I knew any secrets about the new Star Wars movie, which I don't. And I've written for Batman and Superman and lots of movie novelizations, and I've got my own series called the Dan Shamble Zombie PI, and I've got a lot of fans for that, so they come up and they ask me questions about Dan Shamble, the detective, and some of them even dress up in costume like my characters. That's kind of cool when I look up and I go, hey, that's my guy, that's my character. So it's kind of a jazz for me, too, when I see that. And I sign lots of autographs, and we get our photos taken with the fans. And it's just a chance to chat with somebody who's written books that you've read. And it's a good crowd, a good way to meet people with like-minded interests. And you can argue about Star Trek or Star Wars or Blade Runner or Aliens or whatever you want, because you're among your own people. You know, the writing profession, you sit in your office and you play with your imaginary friends and do terrible things to them. But this way I get to go out and meet face-to-face with the people who are my customers, the people reading my books, and I get to hear back from them. And it's just a great way to be open and interact with the people who like your stuff.
Kevin J. Anderson is a best-selling science fiction author whose latest novel, Clockwork Lives, will be released in the spring. You can learn more at wordfire.com and kjablog.com. Still to come, students in Oregon are building their education on a foundation of language. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Students in Oregon will soon face tougher than ever standardized tests on their way to a lofty goal that every student should complete high school starting with the class of 2025. The new tests ask students to think critically and write out explanations. Those skills require a foundation for young students, beginning with language. Rob Manning looks at the connections between language and long-term academic success for all students.
We're going to talk about language in a minute, but first you have to meet Jackie Kahn. He has a whiteboard set up in his grandmother's living room. He's doing serious multiplication while his sisters chatter behind him. He's in first grade.
36 times 12.
What's the answer?
It's 432.
If you can't do that quite as quickly, Jackie got it right. Jackie has been learning math from his dad, Jung Chow Kong. He speaks through a Cantonese interpreter.
Yeah, this is Jackie's double-digit multiplication. This is pretty basic stuff for students in China, but of course not the same for, American students.
Instruction is changing in Oregon. Backers of the National Common Core standards say they're meant to help Americans compete internationally. The standards aim to go deeper with a focus on analysis, context, and applying skills like multiplication. Shannon McCaw trains teachers on the Common Core standards. At a recent conference, she quizzed elementary teachers with sample questions about budgets and restaurant menus.
You read, write, and do math not separately, but oftentimes together. And it's very rare that in life you'll ever be handed a worksheet and say, crank out all these math problems. It's solve this math problem in an applied setting where you have to read and gather information and write about, create some kind of proposal or, something like that.
A recent paper out of Stanford University makes the case that in the Common Core, quote, language permeates all the standards in many ways, even in those cases where the word language is not explicitly mentioned. Language has long been a focus for teaching students who don't use English at home. But language specialist Maria Poppy says there's also an issue for the 75% of students at Earl Boyles Elementary who live in poverty. She reads,
by age 3, middle-class children had working vocabularies roughly twice the size of poor children's. By age 3.
So there's a language gap that happens by age 3.
Right. So those students come in already behind in kindergarten. It's pretty sad. It breaks my heart to even think that.
Language and reading are connected, and with third grade reading a critical milestone, schools often intervene with struggling readers. First grader Dude Rabideau goes to reading club with specialist Katrina Shavita. She uses rapid-fire drills on letter sounds and short words. They keep Dude on his toes.
Top to bottom, bottom to top, Dude. Get ready.
In.
Get ready.
Walk.
Get ready.
It.
Get ready.
It.
Get ready.
Walk.
Get ready.
In.
Awesome job. Way to work it, dude.
Way to work it, dude.
Awesome job.
The reading interventions help struggling readers learn words. Taking those words and putting them together in complete sentences is a school-wide priority at Earl Boyles for Principal Erica Ganay. She says with the recent changes in language instruction, students are using more academic language. How does Ganay measure that? By talking to students.
I say, oh, good morning, good morning so-and-so, how are you today? I get a complete sentence back. I don't get a grunt.
Anais Herrera-Martinez is a first grader at Earl Boyles. Her family speaks English and lives close to school. She recently showed me around her yard, pointing out a broken bicycle and a beehive.
These things people, and they're hurt really bad, and they make poison, but they get honey from flowers. And we have flowers in our garden.
Anais is in the language class for students in greatest need. On this day, she and her classmates get cards with pictures on them, and they have to describe what's happening. Anais is looking at popcorn.
He will pour the little seeds in the popcorn machine.
Then?
Then the popcorn pops. Then last, she and her dad eat together.
The cards help students use complete sentences, but that first, then, last construction is also an early lesson in how to organize thoughts. Some aspects of the new Common Core curriculum and language approach have some teachers and parents nervous. Anais's mom, Josette Herrera, is among them.
What they're learning now is like, they're teaching them way too much, too soon.
Too much too soon? Her daughter's language teacher, Karen McDonald, acknowledges that it's sometimes a struggle for young students. For instance, explaining answers isn't automatic.
At first they were saying it was just in my brain. I just got the answer in my brain. But now they're starting to explain how they got the answer and what picture helped them get the answer.
Mom Josette Herrera says she didn't complain about the demands of first grade because she thinks kids are capable of a lot.
I mean, I understand kids are sponges, and then, I mean, they pick up a lot of stuff, but I think they could have waited.
Karen McDonald says there's no need to wait.
I think they are capable of it. I really do.
Back at Jackie Kong's whiteboard, the 7-year-old's a little unsure how to explain how he solved his multiplication problem. He'd rather run upstairs to play. Jung Chow Kong says putting math into context, as the Common Core will require, is a little beyond his son right now. But he says not for Jackie's older sister.
He hasn't got to that point yet, but Lisa has, obviously. Well, for example, when did they go grocery shopping, you know, dad would ask, hey, you know, how much we're buying, how much money I'm giving, and then what's the change? She knows how to do that. He hasn't been taught that yet.
Jackie's sister Lisa is 10, so she'll be taking the Common Core tests when they start a year from now. Jackie Kong and the rest of the class of 2025 will take them a year later when they're third graders. Rob Manning, OPB News.
Rob Manning's Class of 2025 reports are part of American Graduate, Let's Make It Happen, a public broadcasting initiative to address the dropout crisis, supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Earlier, we spoke to a writer who never seems to run out of great ideas. But what happens when a writer does? That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. Oh, what should I say in this introduction? Perhaps Dan Shalotti, assistant professor of English at Elms College, can help. He's studying the inner workings of writer's block.
All writing begins on a micro level, word leading to word, sentence to sentence. When writers focus on the ideal finished project rather than the sentence or line at hand, they are screening themselves from the fact that what they have in hand is not a map, but a machete. Instead of focusing on the language of the piece of writing, the plan for the piece of writing gets in the way. Writer's block is the state of coping with uncertainty by overplanning. Rebecca Solnit, writing about Virginia Woolf, argues that it's the job of writers and explorers to see more, to travel light when it comes to preconception, to go into the dark with their eyes open. As one does not travel by planning the trip, a writer does not write by mapping the territory of the piece, but by writing the piece. But the writer experiencing writer's block cries, "How do I know what to write about if I do not know what to write about?" George Saunders says that when he has a subject, it tends to be a little dull. He goes on to say that he goes into a story not really sure about what he wants to say, and finds some little seed crystal of interest, and as much as possible divests himself of any deep ideas about it. All writing is made of writing first, not ideas. The writing itself is generative. Walt Whitman writes, "I will not have in my writing any elegance or effect or originality to hang in between me and the rest like curtains. What I tell for precisely what it is." Writer's block is the antithesis of this spirit. When one tries to close one's own eyes in order to fight the dark, it produces anxiety. It is this fear mediated by logic that blocks writers from doing what writers do. Write.
That was Dan Shalotti of Elms College. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at wamc.org.